head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are black hole, black.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Allie Irving for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Oprah Daily. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Daily. The first article is titled, How to Hear Your Adult Child's Criticism of Your Parenting Without Getting Defensive. First things first, listen and acknowledge. Then follow this roadmap to a healing conversation. This article was written by Eleni N. Gage, and it was originally published March 18, 2026. Of all the parenting moments that bring you to your knees, few are more destabilizing than when your adult child questions or criticizes their upbringing. The feeling that the world is dissolving can come from a statement as simple as, "I hated summer camp," when every fiber of your being wants to scream, "You begged to go, you loved it." But the statement can also be overarching and accusatory. You're a narcissist and never put me first. Or, you always favored my brother. Or, you didn't set any boundaries and I never felt safe. When you disagree with one of those whoppers, it's even harder to temper your response. As deeply and fiercely as you love your child, your reaction might be to litigate the past, to marshal witnesses and evidence to prove that your memory of events is the one indisputable truth. But if you want to maintain a relationship with your child, and perhaps your grandchildren, you need to find a way to listen and make your adult child feel heard and understood so you can move into a new phase of your relationship. We turned to experts in the fields of psychology, family therapy, and linguistics for guidance on acknowledging your adult child's memory of their childhood, even when it differs radically from your own. Here's your map. First, understand there are complex reasons this situation is so painful. A child's first relationship is with their parent or parents, and it's the blueprint for every relationship to follow. It's such a vital bond that the need to know your parents value you and your thoughts and feelings extends long past childhood. Does it ever go away? Deborah Tannen, a professor of linguistics at Georgetown University, who is working on a book about apologies, found in her research that for adults who sought an apology from their parents, the impetus was wanting to have their sense of reality reinforced by the people who could do it. It wasn't so much the apology per se, but they wanted their hurt acknowledged and to feel that the parent responsible cared. The stakes are fraught for the parent as well. The author of several books about communication, including You're Wearing That, Understanding Mothers and Daughters in Conversation, Tannen adds that so many women told me the one level of criticism that they really couldn't handle was that they were not good mothers. In the face of such weighty emotions, an adult parent of a child who brings up a controversial memory may be tempted to resort to one or all of the three D's: deny, downplay, or dismiss. Tannen says denial can sound like, "That didn't really happen." Downplaying is comparing the child's discomfort to kids who suffered more or to your own experience. "It wasn't that bad. It could have been so much worse." Dismissal is, "Yeah, big deal. You felt bad then. So what?" None of these are what your adult child wants to hear. To use the parlance of the day, they might feel gaslit or like their inner child is being ignored all over again. Tracy Ross, who sees this kind of conflict often in her practice as a family therapist for parents and their adult children, understands the impulse to resort to the three D's. If you realize you failed your child inadvertently, it brings up a lot of shame. It's human nature to say, "That's not how I remember it. It's better if we don't talk," she says. But that's never going to get you anywhere. Remember, there is no one truth. Yes, it can be gutting to hear that your adult child's memories of their childhood don't match with your own, but it shouldn't be surprising. As Lawrence Steinberg, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Temple University, and the author, most recently, of You and Your Adult Child, points out, People in the same family always have very different perceptions of what the family dynamics are like, partly because we all have different memories, and partly because we experience relationships in different ways from each other, even when we're in the same relationship. The upshot for parents who disagree with their adult children: it's not like one of them is right and one of them is wrong, says Steinberg. In her practice, Ross urges both the parents and their adult child to move past trying to sell each other on their version. A lot of people get very stuck in, "If I can convince you of my version, then you're not going to feel upset anymore," she says. And that does not work. Offer context, not excuses. After hearing your child's side of the story, it's natural that you'll want to share yours. And in a best-case scenario, doing so is an opportunity for everyone to become closer. We find in our research that up until a certain age, let's say 20 or so, kids have a hard time seeing their parents as people, says Steinberg. But once the child is an adult, you can offer information about what you were going through at the time that may be relevant. Steinberg says that you should come from a place of, "I'm not saying that you are wrong. I'm just saying that here's something that you should know about what was going on in my life. Whether it was your own parents aging, marriage or career stress, or another factor." Steinberg suggests concluding with a statement like, "I'm sorry that this made me be less effective or not as good a parent as I wanted to be." What you don't want to do is sound like you're justifying whatever hurt your child. Linguistically, Tannen says, it's the "but" that's a problem, as in, "I'm sorry, but." This is why Ross cautions parents against saying, "I'm sorry, but I was doing the best I could at the time." That puts the emphasis on you, not them, and implies that your best efforts still left them in pain. Where can you go from there? Instead, she urges parents to say something like, I did what I did, not realizing the impact it had on you. I was thinking about myself, or my marriage, or my career, or my own parents, and I wasn't focused on you, and I just missed it. In other words, name the pain you caused, even if you couldn't have done things differently at the time. Finally, acknowledge and apologize. Ultimately, you want to work toward a resolution. Your goal, says Steinberg, should be to give your child an opportunity to express what he or she thinks, and to not try to correct it, but to hear it and to try to understand it. So put aside your ego and try this response from Ross. "Yes, you were unhappy and uncomfortable in that moment, and yes, I thought that was a great time for our family. And both might be true. I think I might have been in my own world, and that you were unhappy and I missed it. I'm sorry about that." Adds Ross, "Own any part of it. If you don't own the whole version, own 5, 10, 20%. If you do, all the defenses, all the coping mechanisms, all the things that keep people distant can sort of soften. That softening can help everyone move past the pain instead of rehashing it eternally. You're not going to undo it," Steinberg says. "But you can say, let's go forward from here. What can we do to make our relationship better?" The second article is titled, "The Poop Doctor is In, The Surprising Science Behind Gut Feelings." That stinking or sinking or fluttery, feeling isn't intuition. It's your nervous system trying to protect you. This article was written by Tricia Pasricha, MD, MPH, and originally published March 17, 2026. "My mom works for the FBI. That was a statement that used to stop most people in their tracks when I was growing up. I followed my father's path in becoming a gastroenterologist, but the person who first introduced me to how the brain influences our gut was my mother. In order to land a job with a top secret clearance at the FBI, my mother first had to pass a lie detector test. On a humid D.C. afternoon in 1986, she walked into a brutalist concrete building downtown and was hooked up to an electrocardiogram. The interrogator began a series of questions, all straightforward enough, until one: 'Do your friends sometimes call you Rena?' Now, if this had been a casual question at a bar, the answer would have been an immediate yes, of course. But this was an FBI interrogation with her dream job on the line. Her friends always called her Rena. That was her first name. She didn't go by a nickname. She could feel her heart racing. Why did he say sometimes? Was that supposed to mean something? Rena's stomach sank, curling into a hollow pit. The agent paused. Let's try that again. Do your friends always call you Rena? Ah, Rena felt a sudden wave of relief. Yes, they do, she said confidently. She passed her test, but she noticed something odd. Although she had stopped sweating and her heart was no longer pounding, her gut was anything but calm. That sinking feeling lingered, though the hurdle was over. She told me this story when I was a little girl, and it got me wondering if we could measure that sinking feeling in our abdomens that so truly reflected our inner turmoil. I was in seventh grade when I hatched a plan. My gastroenterologist father was studying how the stomach has its own electrical rhythm, just like the heart. Using an electrogastrogram, a device that places painless electrodes on the abdomen, you could read that signal. What if psychological stress changed it, even in healthy people? And if the stress of telling a lie caused a change in our gut's electrical rhythm, we should be able to detect it. For the next few years, I recruited over a dozen healthy adults and ran the experiment. To prevent any bias on my part, I did not know when subjects were randomly assigned to tell the truth or lie. But as I analyzed the data, a clear pattern emerged. At certain times, the electrical tracings in the stomach transformed from an elegant, coordinated baseline of 3 cycles per minute to pure chaos. It turned out that chaotic arrhythmia happened significantly more during periods when participants had been lying. The study got me a mention in the New York Times, an NPR interview between classes, and eventually second place at the Intel International Science Fair. But what it really taught me was something I now spend my career helping patients understand. Those phrases we toss around, butterflies in the stomach, a sinking feeling, a gut feeling, are not metaphors. They are real physiology. Stress, fear, excitement, and anxiety all activate the autonomic nervous system, and one of its main targets is the gut. The gut responds instantly to that information, often before your conscious brain has time to catch up. Here's what we get wrong. A gut feeling isn't necessarily intuition floating in the ether. It's your body running a rapid risk assessment based on context, memory, threat, and uncertainty, and priming your gut for the necessary response. So rather than thinking of a gut feeling as a verdict, think of it purely as a message. And that message is simple. The stakes are higher than you realized. When you feel that signal, it's often better if you don't immediately act on it. Instead, you should pause. Ask what your body might be registering that your conscious mind hasn't caught up with yet. Imagine, for example, that a proposal comes up at a work meeting. On paper, it makes sense, but your gut tightens. Conventional wisdom would tell us, trust your gut, something must be wrong. But sometimes your gut isn't flagging danger, but novelty. You feel the discomfort of uncertainty because you've never approached the problem from that angle. The signal may not mean, don't do this. It may be, pay closer attention because this matters. Flip the scenario. You're on a date and everything feels easy. Conversation flows. But there are no butterflies in your stomach. Pop culture tells us that if there isn't a spark, something's missing. But sometimes what your gut is actually telling you is that you feel safe. There's no adrenaline because your nervous system isn't on high alert. And in a culture that romanticizes intensity, we sometimes mistake calm for boredom, when in reality, it's regulation. Your gut is better than most tools at our disposal at flagging significance. And learning to listen without panic or dismissal is one of the most powerful things we can do. So instead of trusting your gut, do even better. Translate it. That was from You've Been Pooping All Wrong, How to Make Your Bowel Movements a Joy by Tricia Pastrika, MD, MPH, to be published on April 7, 2026 by Avery, an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC. Our next article is called The Problem with the Perfect Decision. Perfectionism is actually a trauma response, and it may be silencing your truest desires. This article was written by Niloufer Merchant and originally published March 20th, 2026. We want rightness. It feels clear. It feels comforting. But it doesn't work. That's because the world is not fixed. It's dynamic, complex, and full of nuance. Life doesn't fit into rigid categories of always or never, good or bad, right or wrong. The moment we try to impose absolutes, we erase context, flexibility, and the ability to adapt. And yet, we crave righteousness. It feels safe. This is where most of us get stuck. We treat decisions like moral absolutes, as if the wrong choice will ruin everything. This is the perfectionist's trap. Perfectionism, the disposition to regard anything short of perfect as unacceptable, is so commonplace that most don't question it. But perfectionism isn't clarity. It's a trauma response. It often develops as a way to cope with feelings of insecurity, fear, or past experiences of criticism, neglect, or unpredictability. If someone grows up in an environment where love or approval is conditional, based on performance, achievement, or avoiding mistakes, perfectionism becomes a survival strategy. It creates the illusion of control and safety. If I do everything perfectly, I won't be rejected, shamed, or hurt. And like many trauma responses, what once served to protect can easily become a cage. At work, it definitely does. In our professional lives, perfectionism is how we chronically deny our own truth as we stifle creativity and growth. Because the real goal isn't to be perfect, it's to be fully ourselves. Isn't that the tension? We seek perfection at the expense of our own humanity, yet the future requires us to be fully alive. Which begs the question of whether we even know how to tap into our own desires, to know what matters to us. No one else stands in that spot in the world where you do, shaped by your history and experiences, your ideas, your aspirations. Naming what matters is about tuning into that. What do you crave? What energizes you? What is something you would do even if no one were paying you? Oftentimes, what comes to mind looks too easy or too simple and is discarded because it's so obvious to you. If something feels obvious to you, you assume it can't be that important. In fact, the opposite is true. The thing that is so obvious to you is nearly always the foundation of who you are. So before you list your potential next steps, ask, what do I always want, independent of what others expect? What would I pursue if I weren't afraid of making the wrong choice? What, when I imagine doing it, feels like home? And ask a friend, what lights me up? It's as if we were all born with a certain shade of light bulb on top of our heads, illuminating everything around us. It could be tangerine orange or cobalt blue. You can't tell what it is because it's all you've ever seen. But when you enter a room, others immediately perceive the change, exclaiming, "Wow, it just got cobalt in here." None of us can see our distinct attributes, as these qualities are so intrinsic to our being that they become almost invisible to us. But our friends can be helpful if they reflect back to us, "What you always seem to care about is this." We often think right decisions create success. In reality, our commitment to a path creates success. The best option isn't the one that comes pre-validated. It's the one you choose and then make right for you. This is the shift we need. Away from, is this right or wrong? Toward, how does it work for me? We don't find the perfect path. We build it by showing up and chasing down the thing that matters to us. And even if we get something wrong, that isn't the end. It's just another step. You go, whoops, that didn't work. Let's try another way. This essay is adapted from Our Best Work, Break Free from the 24 Invisible Norms That Limit Us by Niloufer Merchant, who is ranked among the top 50 influential management thinkers in the world. One of her TED Talks has been referenced 300 million times. Our last article for today, Why Oversharing is the Antidote to Loneliness. According to this Harvard Business School professor, the roadblock to healthy relationships isn't TMI, it's TLI, revealing too little information. This article was written by Leslie John and originally published March 10, 2026. I've been studying disclosure decisions for about 20 years, decisions about what and how much we reveal about ourselves and what we're thinking and feeling, essentially how much I is TMI and how much is too little. We make these choices every day, at work and at home, with our spouses, friends, colleagues, and even strangers. Do you tell a friend that you're hurt that they didn't include you? Do you tell your spouse that you're feeling distant, or your parent that you're worried they're no longer safe behind the wheel? Do you tell your boss you're struggling, or that you think you deserve a raise? So often we suppress what we're thinking and feeling, not because we have nothing to say, but because we're afraid of saying the wrong thing or of what might happen next. The result is a persistent, under-recognized problem. It's not too much information, but too little, TLI. Undersharing quietly costs us. Friendships that never deepen, colleagues who never quite trust us, romances that never spark. Of course, there's a reason too much information exists as a warning. That line between TMI and TLI can be gossamer thin. One detail too many about your health problems and your boss's concern may give way to questions about your competence. If you share that juicy bit of gossip about a coworker with another colleague, your confidant might be flattered and respond with a juicy morsel in turn, and voila, friends for life. Then again, the colleague you shared with might worry you'll gossip about them as well, leading them to keep their distance from you. So yes, it's tricky to get it right. But when we do, when we share enough to be known to others but not flayed by them, we unlock extraordinary rewards, like finding the love of your life. Indeed, I tested that theory the hard way. Enter dating apps. Lessons from Love and the Science of Opening Up. At 35, my life looked inevitably intact. I loved my job, my friends, my family. Every morning, I crossed the Harvard footbridge to work, watching the rowing team slice through the Charles. On paper, everything was serene. Inside, I was a mess. My marriage wasn't working, and after months of agonizing, we ended it. That's how I found myself dipping a wary toe into swiping culture. The academic turned lab rat in her own field study. The first hurdle? My profile's relationship status. Separated? Too messy. Divorced? Too much. Why do apps make the freshly unmarried carry a scarlet D? Rage. And that was just the beginning of my disclosure dilemmas. How much to say in a dating profile? How long to text before getting stuck in a pen pal sitch? And so on. Every night when I got home from work, I'd pour myself a stiff vodka soda, a drink chosen not for its taste, but its exceptional booze-to-calorie ratio. I'd then spend 30 minutes on the apps. Yes, it was a chore, though not so bad as far as chores go. And the dates? Well, I earned that vodka soda. There was the time I bailed out of a moving vehicle. No, I wasn't in danger, just pathologically averse to a looming goodbye kiss. There was a time I slyly texted my friends during a ho-hum date, asking them to stage a totally coincidental run-in. And, lest I forget, the steady parade of not-as-advertised profile pics. Call me callous, but eventually, before first dates, I started pausing outside the bar to peer in. And if I didn't recognize the guy from his photos, I'd just keep walking. After so many disappointments, I did what any self-respecting behavioral scientist would do. I opened Excel and therapized myself with data collection. After so many disappointments, I realized I was failing at two distinct phases of the operation. First, how to increase the odds of meeting someone I actually wanted to see again. And second, once I knew I didn't, how to end things kindly but clearly. Naturally, this required two tabs, one for attraction, the other for extraction. That second one tracked my methods of letting people down, for example, honest no, or more commonly, white lie, ghost, and their outcomes, angry reply, number of follow-up attempts, and so on. I also captured my reactions when I was on the receiving end. After enough failed experiments, I stumbled on the Kismet variable, degree of apparent mutual curiosity. The dates that had potential weren't the ones where I was impressed or he seemed impressed. Rather, they were the ones where we were equally intent on discovering each other. So, I built a first date strategy around it. I'd ask question after question and see if they reciprocated. Meanwhile, back in my bachelorette pad, I kept at it. Until one evening, one swipe changed my life forever. I finished my nightly quota by right swiping, I like to end things on a positive note, on a profile that simply said, "See." A warm smile, soulful eyes, three lines of text. Educated, shy, former professional soccer player. Well played. Research shows that in the opening moves, minimalism helps, since dissimilarities repel more than similarities attract. The next morning, boom, a match, and a message. We traded a few quick lines and agreed to meet for coffee in Harvard Square. Pro tip, long pre-meeting banter tends to inflate expectations and deflate chemistry. I arrived first. Then a tall, devastatingly handsome man walked up, well-dressed but not overdressed. Yum. "Hi, I'm Colin," he said. The spark and the undershare. I still remember the flushed, ridiculous jolt of adrenaline when we first met. As a scientist, I'd long rolled my eyes at love at first sight. Now here I was, seriously smitten. From the beginning, Colin was different from every other date in a good way. Charming in conversation, yet careful, too. The date unfolded with a kind of ease. I stopped keeping count of the questions. We kept seeing each other, our conversations gradually deepening. I told him I was divorced. He leaned in and shared something vulnerable about his family history. A few months later, he worked up the courage to say, "I think I love you." My response, "Me, you too." Me, you too? Yes, the words that came out of my mouth were technically affirmative, but they were also evasive. He had just done something risky and brave, naming his feelings plainly, but instead of meeting him there, I retreated into nervous shorthand. I didn't let him see how deeply I felt it, too. Then his reaction said it all. He gave a small, tight smile, looked down at the table, and quietly changed the subject to weekend logistics. In that one, tiny but fateful moment, I'd failed to match his vulnerability. Over the next few days and weeks, we both pulled back. Conversations got shallower, flirty banter dissipated. Eventually, we broke up. But I was lucky. I got a second chance. A few months later, one crisp fall day, I came home to discover an envelope on my doorstep. Leslie K. John was written on it in Colin's distinctive hand. No address, no stamp. He had been here himself. Inside was a letter. "If I'm being honest with myself, I know that I do love you," he wrote. "I was scared to admit it, scared to let myself be in love, and all that meant." The first time he'd said, "I think I love you," that "think" had stuck with me. I had mistaken it for ambivalence. The love letter made clear to me that he had been doing something brave, naming a feeling that most of us struggle to even whisper. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Daily. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Allie Irving, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Oprah Daily is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are.